Good morning. Welcome to the Citadel on this Sunday, the 25th of October. This is the York City Church live stream. My name's Alan Rose, and we're going to hear now our scripture readings for today.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea. Though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble with its tumult. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city, it shall not be moved. God will help it when the morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord. See what desolations he has brought on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Then Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." They answered him, "We are descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not have a permanent place in the household. The son has a place there forever. So if the son makes you free, you will be free indeed."
Well, where I grew up on the south coast of England, there was a large section of clifftop that was continually being eroded by the sea. And over a spell of a few years, there were paths and benches that were nice lookout spots over across the Isle of Wight, and even houses and caravans that ended up at the bottom of the cliff because of the constant coastal erosion. And loads of money was ploughed into trying to make the cliff stable, but nevertheless, it continued to erode, and eventually it's going to get to Berkshire or something, I don't know. But it's continually eroding. My mother-in-law lives nowhere near the sea, but over the road from where her house is, a few years ago, one family opened their front door one morning to discover that a sinkhole had opened up on their driveway and swallowed up their car whole. All you could see was the rear end of a little Mini poking out of the ground. Now, I imagine that there are few things more disconcerting then discovering that what you thought had previously been solid and dependable and secure, enduringly solid even, is crumbling away beneath your feet, is actually rather insubstantial. And in the psalm that we just heard read for us by Emily Olty, Psalm 46, the psalmist uses the language of cliffs being eroded away. It says mountains in the reading that we heard there, but it's describing mountainous cliffs along the coast. And it describes the earth giving way. And the reason that the psalmist is reflecting on these things is because the psalmist is reflecting on God as a refuge and a helper, one who makes even the most solid of substances seem like semolina in comparison to his faithful presence. So the psalm makes this confident assertion: God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. You notice that the language is plural there, not individualistic. It's plural. God is our refuge and strength, therefore we will not fear. This psalm is certainly not therapeutic religion for individualistic Western Christians, but ancient wisdom that understands God's commitment to his people and reflects on the realities of life in the light of God's utter commitment to his people. And the psalm speaks hypothetically. We could almost translate it, I think some translations of the Bible do, as even if the earth should change and the sea overwhelm the cliffs, even if all that we thought was solid and dependable falls away, we will trust. Now, the language of water is really important in this psalm, beginning with the sea in the opening stanza. And it's really a metaphor. Although the psalmist talks about the sea raging and foaming, it's a metaphor. It's describing the sea in personal terms, almost as if it's describing a person, maybe an enemy, although there's no specific enemy or enemies that are mentioned in this psalm. It makes it sound like the sea is a raging, roaring, personified being somehow that is railing against the cliffs. Maybe it's supposed to describe an enemy, or maybe it's supposed to be open, so that when we read and engage with this psalm a long, long way distant historically from when it was written, we might find that it speaks to our own challenges and difficult scenarios, conflicts perhaps. However we understand it, it's important to see that in some Jewish understanding, not all, but some Jewish understanding, the sea could represent the chaotic powers that threaten the shalom, the wholeness, the good ordering of God's creation. And so the Jews were not a big seafaring nation. They were a bit suspicious of the sea. It's this murky, changeable, dangerous thing that sometimes seems like it's going to overwhelm all that is stable and solid in our lives. Now, that just helps us understand this psalm a little bit more. It helps us to get to grips with what's going on, because talking about the sea isn't just arbitrary then. It's not just what we need some kind of thing to talk. What can we find to kind of shoehorn into this psalm to make sure that there's some image in there? That's not really what's happening. The sea is chosen specifically because it represents the powers of chaos and evil even that threaten the order of God's good world and therefore the well-being and the wholeness of God's people. The psalm is saying, even if the chaotic forces of evil look like they have overwhelmed God's divinely ordered creation and brought chaos right to our doorstep, even so, we will not fear. Wow, that's a pretty bold statement of faith, isn't it? And perhaps for you and I living in the current climate, we might find that this speaks to us, even though chaotic forces look like they are going to overwhelm all that we love and hold dear and think is solid and dependable, still we will not fear. Now, I wanted to ask a question and pose a question of us, because the psalm speaks in that sense of even if all of this stuff unfolds. And I want to make a suggestion to you that there's a massive difference between being an even if follower of Jesus or an only if follower of Jesus. Here's what I mean. You can say, I will follow Jesus as my Lord, even if it means hardship, sacrifice, unmet expectations, delays, disappointments, unfulfilled desires, changes in life circumstances that I didn't see coming, even if I will follow you, Lord. I would say that that's a Christian, right? Someone who has said, Jesus, you are Lord, and no matter what else, I will walk with you, I will follow you. The alternative is to be an only if believer. I will follow Jesus as Lord only if, well, you can fill in the blank, can't you? Only if my plans succeed. Only if I get what I wanted out of God. Only if I get a nice, tidy, neat life, no alarms, no surprises. Only if I get those things, well, then I might think about it. It's a big difference between being an even if, trusting follower, disciple, like the psalm describes, or an only if follower that's only in it for the benefits and not for the allegiance to the one whom we claim to trust. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but the psalm carries forward the water metaphor into the middle section. There is a river, says the psalmist, whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. Now, most interpreters, most commentators on the Psalms regard this verse as a reference to the city of Jerusalem, the place where God's temple dwelt, where God lived in and amongst his people. And I think that that's probably right. I think that it is talking about Jerusalem. But that is not without its problems, because there were no rivers in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is on a mountain, and you don't tend to find rivers at the top of mountains with streams that water it. And in actual fact, historically, we could say that Jerusalem had problems getting water to it, even. It wasn't that easy. So how can we speak about a city, Jerusalem, with rivers and streams that make it glad? What's going on there? Well, let's remember that just as the metaphor of the sea and the powers of chaos and conflict and everything, just as the sea is a metaphor there, so also is the language of rivers and streams when it speaks about the city. What the psalmist is describing is God's presence in the city that safeguards the city from the roaring, raging chaos of the sea, whether that be foreign armies or whether it be other types of threat. The psalmist is describing something that says, although there's this power and this chaos outside the walls of the city, within the city, all is well, all is peace and shalom and confidence because God dwells here. God's presence dwells in the city. God is in the midst of the city, we read. It shall not be moved. God will help it when morning dawns. And that last phrase is really interesting, when morning dawns, because it comes from the Exodus story. In the Exodus story, God delivers his people, the Israelites, from slavery in Egypt, and he opens a way for them to pass through the waters of the Red Sea on dry ground. And then we read that Moses, when morning dawned, looked, and the waters folded back in on the Egyptian army as they pursued the Israelites, as they tried to overwhelm the Israelites. So here's another water point. At this moment, when morning dawned, just as it looked like armies were going to overwhelm the people of God as they escaped Egypt, the waters came back in at God's command and drowned the Egyptian army, and the people of Israel were delivered. They were safe. So the psalmist reflects on Israel's story, which is our story, God's deliverance, God's power, God's commitment to his people, God's rescue. And he says, hey, there may be chaotic powers at force in the world, but God's presence with his people, God's people in their midst safeguards us. God's waters in our midst are not chaotic. They are gentle and joy-bringing and peace-giving. We will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains fall into the sea. God is a river whose streams make glad the place where he dwells, the people among whom he dwells. No wonder The psalmist says, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." It's beautiful. What a wonderful picture. And then the psalm goes on to extend an invitation to think about what God has done. And perhaps that Exodus reference there is intended to jog the memory a little bit. Oh, yeah, when morning dawns. We remember another morning that dawned when God delivered us from our enemies. Perhaps for you and I as Christians who look back to not the sea closing up over Egyptian armies, but look back to a moment where Christ was crucified and where the powers of darkness were overcome by the love of God and the blood spilt on the cross. We remember, we think back to the events of the past. Not in a kind of, oh, remember, not in some wistful way, but in a sense that says God is with us. God has overcome our enemies. Chaos is finished for us, and life and peace and shalom is ours now through faith in him. We remember how God has worked. Now, for the psalmist and his audience, there's an invitation to the nations of the world, perhaps, to reflect on Israel's God, to realize that this is something that God does, that Israel's God, the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, he is a refuge and a strength. But it also speaks to what we could call wibbly-wobbly believers, people who are a bit jelly-like in their faith when trouble comes. Oh, friends, that's all of us, isn't it, sometimes? We all know times of knee-knocking anxiety, when we didn't see things coming, where something in life just sweeps in from the side somewhere, and we're just all a little bit, freaking out, don't know what to do. Well, we need to reflect on the psalm here, and we need to allow the scriptures to direct our minds and our hearts to God, and to reflect on God's actions for us in the past, as a basis for trusting him now in the present. So what is it then that God has done in this psalm? Well, that's a good question. When we read on into the final section, we find that he is a God who makes wars cease. That's very interesting. He makes conflicts stop. He shatters bows and spears. And he burns defenses, shields. But I've not really told it to you correctly there. You see, that was very vague and general. But the psalm is incredibly specific. The psalm says he breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the shields with fire. God is personally and practically involved at the level of making wars and chaos and conflict to cease. He is personally involved. Oh, it's easy, isn't it, to speak about God on this big sweeping terms. But here it's very, very like practical and specific. God breaks the bow, shatters the spear. And then we get the famous verse, the one that adorns screensavers and fridge magnets the Christian world over. Be still and know that I am God. The be still and know that I am God housewives Bible. The be still and know that I am God 9-to-5 working man's diary. The be still and know that I am God youth work resources. It's everywhere, isn't it? I don't own any of those, by the way, just to be clear. Sometimes this verse is used to encourage, how shall we say, hyperactive Christians to just chill out a little bit, to be a little bit less anxious, to be a little bit less busy, to stop running around like a headless chicken for the Lord. And that's helpful. And sometimes as Christians, we need to be told, just stop already, chill out, just relax. Sometimes it's used as an encouragement for Christians to have a bit of a retreat, to get away from it all, to go somewhere silent, to be still and silent before God and to seek to hear his voice away from the hubbub of everyday life. Again, very useful, very helpful, very tangible. We need moments like that. But it's questionable whether that's really what this verse is saying, given the context of the rest of the psalm. It's not really a word spoken to over-anxious believers. It's a word spoken to the powers of chaos. It's a word spoken to the raging seas. It's a word spoken to warring powers right in the middle of the conflict. You see, where God's voice comes in this psalm is not somewhere else. It's right here. It's on the battlefield. God is on the battlefield, breaking bows, shattering spears, burning shields, and saying, "Enough! I am God! Stop!" Right? That's where this is. God is right there. Now, how did the psalm begin? God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Now, we all like to think that the present help with God is when we withdraw from the trouble. I'm going to back away from the trouble. There's the trouble. I'm going to go far away from the trouble, and then God is going to be present with me and help me. But that's not what the psalm is describing. The psalm is describing God's presence right there in the nitty-gritty of the trouble. Now, that's a little bit different, and that's less comfortable than what we're used to or what we want, but God is there in the trouble. He's there on the battlefield. That's where God's voice is heard, right in the midst of all the chaos. Be still and know that I am God. But I want you to see as well that it's related to what he then goes on to say. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. The point of saying that, of course, is to highlight that right in the very place where powers and human rulers think that they have full sway and full control, the reality is that it is Yahweh, it is Jehovah, it is God who is high and lifted up. He is sovereign over all the world affairs that go on. Nothing is happening in the dark away from his sight. Nothing is going on away from his sovereign insight and his guidance and his providence. He is exalted in the nations. He is exalted in the earth. And so he says, be still to the raging powers of chaos. Know that I am God. Maybe you'd like to think to the end of Mark chapter 4, where Jesus, in a boat with some terrified disciples, does the very thing that Yahweh God says to the powers of chaos when he says to the waves, be still! And there was a flat calm. And the disciples say, well, who then is this? And the question hangs in the air, because God does this kind of stuff. And this is Jesus doing it. He speaks stillness, peace to chaos. But he doesn't speak it from a far off, distant place. He speaks it right there in the very midst of it all. If you're looking for the stilling, calming, peace-giving, helpful voice of God by trying to get away from all the trouble, you're probably looking in the wrong place. He is a very present help in trouble. He is right there in the very midst of it. He speaks his comforting words right there in the middle of the chaos. Now, God might be exalted in the nations. God may be exalted in the earth, but the psalmist says he is with us. That's very, very important to notice. God is sovereign over all things. He is high and lifted up. He is majestic and holy and other and powerful. He is transcendent and magnificent. He is eternally simple and profound and beautiful. Yet, he is with us. Outside the wall of your heart, there may be all kinds of chaos, relationships, jobs, sickness, friendships, parenting, finances, all kinds of stuff can be going on. God is with you. Yes, he is glorious. Yes, he is sovereign. Yes, he is outside of your ability to be able to define and grasp. But nevertheless, he is with you, a very present help in trouble. He is your refuge and strength. He is our, as a church, refuge and strength. Therefore, we will not fear. And if we won't fear, then you don't need to fear. And if you're not fearing, that's great, because we're not afraid. God is with us. So I'm going to wrap this sermon up this week with a slightly unusual instruction, one that you're probably not particularly familiar with hearing on the lips of a Christian preacher. In fact, it will probably sound to some of you like Christian unorthodoxy. Are you ready? I've set this up nicely, haven't I? We almost need some kind of drum roll going on in the background. There's no one here to play the drums. This week, on the back of this sermon, my instruction to you is, do not try and live for God. There it is. Don't try and live for God this week. Don't do it. Don't try. Abandon it. I don't want you trying to live for God this week. Yeah, I'm serious. Because instead, I want you to go away from this sermon after the 20 minutes of excruciating trying to fellowship with one another on Zoom in a few minutes' time. And I want you to think and to reflect and to figure out and to meditate on. This is your homework, if you like. I want you to go away and figure out what it means to live with God. Because God is with you. And if God is with you, then trying to live for God can be a complete waste of time. And here's what I mean. See, you can live for God, and it's all wrong because it's false humility and unbelief wrapped up in a wrapping of piety. Oh, I have a quiet time every day. Oh, of course, I read my Bible and I pray. But then you can be freaking out and living however you want the rest of the time. You can live for God, but then resent God because you thought and you believed that the way it worked was I scratch his back and he scratches mine, hopefully. But he's not scratched your back. You did all that stuff. You kept your nose clean. You served on a team in church. But God hasn't given you what you wanted, and now you're cross because God did not give you the goods. So you resent him. I lived for God, and he didn't do what I thought he would. Or you can live for God by trying to buffer yourself from God, ironically. I mean, how ironic is that? You're trying to live for God, but the last thing that you want is God, because you don't want him turning your life inside out. You just want to do things for God because it somehow keeps God at bay. I'm living for God. I'm involved in the work of the Lord. And all the time, the Lord of the work is going, hi. Or you can live, and I think this is a lot of us. You can live for God, but be racked with guilt because you don't think you do enough. Oh, you know you were saved by grace. Don't get me wrong. You know that. You know it all. Oh, I know who I am in Christ. I know that I'm saved by grace. But you're anxious and you feel guilty because you never feel that you do enough to repay the crushing debt of what God did for you. And so I've got to live for God. And you're never able to just enjoy the peace and the joy of being accepted, of being delighted in because you're breathing and nothing else. Or perhaps you even feel guilty that what you do is not enough. It's not good enough. It's not fruitful enough. It doesn't produce enough results, and so I feel bad, and so I should try harder. Friends, that's a life before God. It's much different if you seek to live a life with God, where he's central to everything, where everything else flows out of knowing and receiving and accepting and delighting in his presence with you as gift. Just because. Why does God love you? Just because. He loves you because he loves you because he loves you. And so out of that place of his love for you comes all kinds of fruits. And sure, you end up doing things, but you're doing them with God rather than for God. And it completely alters the perspective and the kind of activity that you do and the kind of heart with which you do it. So don't try and live for God this week. I don't know what your external circumstances are like today. I don't know how chaotic it feels for you. Certainly nationally, things are chaotic, aren't they? Who knows how many days we are away from going into tier three. But it can be chaos on the outside. But we will not fear, because there is a stream whose rivers make glad the city of God, the presence of God with us. Sure, he is exalted in the nations and in the earth, but he's with us. Go and work out this week what it means for you to more and more live a life with God. Amen. Have a great afternoon.